أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا أبو القاسم محمد
اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد
وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. السلام عليكم brothers and sisters, thank you again for coming and listening to me speak. Inshallah, we could open this speech by sending three loud salawats upon the Imam Salman, speaking about why Imam Hussein alayhi salam decided to stand up and give his life, about what were the reasons behind the uprising of Ashura, about what were the reasons behind the Husseini movement, what caused Imam Hussein to make this huge sacrifice. We've mentioned many different reasons. All of them so far, the majority of them, have been about social issues. Today is also a social issue, but it's considered the key of all the other social issues. So tonight is an important reason. It might even be the most important reason why Imam Hussein alayhi salam stood up. Tonight's reason is establishing an Islamic government. Imam Hussein alayhi salam stood up, rose up, sacrificed everything in order to have the opportunity, or in order to try to move closer to establishing an Islamic government. Now you might be asking, what's so important about that? You might be thinking that politics and religion are separated, so this can't be right. But in order to understand it, first we have to look and try to see why it is a necessity to have an Islamic government. Why having a government run by a religious person, by someone ordained by Allah, implementing the laws of Islam, is something necessary for this world. And with the loud salawat, we'll get into it.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
We know that Allah sent prophets to mankind. Every one of these prophets had goals. The goals of all of the prophets were the same for the most part. There were universal goals that every prophet shared. For instance, teaching. Teaching the religion of God, of Allah. This is a goal that every prophet had. Now, let's look at just this one aspect of teaching. Let's compare how Muslims are taught in an Islamic government to how Muslims are taught in a non-Islamic government. For instance, where we are right now. Now, when in this discussion that I'm giving you, I know that we have one Islamic government in this world, but when I'm talking about Islamic government, unless I mention Iran, I'm talking about the ideal theory or the ideal aspect of Iran. So, When we talk about teaching, don't tell me in Iran they teach like this. Okay? What I'm talking about is the ideal Islamic government. How would a child be taught? And you would see that in this ideal Islamic government, you would see the child would be taught every day in his school, just as he's growing up until he becomes 18 or whatever the age is. Every day he'll be taught in accordance to Islamic law. The schools will be schools that he would be able to grow both intellectually and spiritually. They would be perfect schools. They would be exactly what we want for our children. Now let's compare that to what we have here. In the West, in America, we send our children to schools. Now if we send them to public schools, they are not exposed at all to religion. And if they are, they're exposed in a negative way, because the schools promote religion in a negative way. If we send them to Muslim schools, we might send them to Al-Hadi, for instance, or other Muslim schools. We suffer in the quality of education. Now, I don't want to knock these schools. These schools are doing the best that they can. They're trying the best with the resources that they have, and they're doing a great service to the community. But if we honestly look at it, the quality of education in these places don't compare to the quality of education in public schools or even some private schools that are even much better than that. So what do? We send our kids to school, and on Sunday we bring them to the mosque and we have Sunday school. One day a week, they learn a little bit about Islam and go home. For the rest of the week, they're in a secular environment. So you could, if we had an Islamic government, if we had an Islamic society, we'd be able to teach the children the way that they should. When we don't, we have to compromise for these things. It's clear that an Islamic government is much better. It's clear that with an Islamic government, the goal of the prophets, which is teaching people about the religion of Allah, would be achieved. If we don't have the Islamic government, it won't be achieved. There's no way that it would be achieved. We can't reach that. Let's look at some other goals of the prophets. Another goal of the prophet is establishing social justice. We cannot implement justice when the laws of the country we live in are not just. It's impossible. The only way that the laws of a country would be just is if they're in accordance with what Allah says. If the laws are based upon the Quran and the Sunnah, they would be just. Otherwise, some of them would be just and some of them wouldn't. So again, it's necessary to have an Islamic government. The third goal, and this is the last goal that I'll mention before we get into the same subject but on a different angle, is slavery. We see, first of all, when we hear the word slavery, we think of the physical slavery, like the Africans were enslaved in America, right? This is what we think of. I'm not talking about physical slavery, but people are enslaved in America. People are enslaved in the UK. People are enslaved all throughout the world. How? I'll give you three instances. One, consumerism. Look at how people spend money in the West. People are attached to these things that we have. We have to have A, B, C, and D. If I go to school, I have to have all new clothes. I have to have a new backpack. When I go to work, I have to get this. We have to buy a bigger TV. We have to have a bigger house, a better car. Always people in the United States are thinking about what they need to buy. If you look at the statistics, the population of the United States makes up 5% of the population of the world, give or take. But the amount of buying and selling, the amount of consumerism that is in America is 80%. So 80% of the world's wealth is being used in America, which constitutes only 5% of the world's population. And of course, alhamdulillah, we're Muslim and we're not attached to our material things. So I know that this isn't the case with you guys. But if you take away the smallest thing from an American on the street, he won't be able to take it. If he loses his job, you see what happens all the time in America. You see what happens in the schools and in workplaces when someone loses something. They go crazy and they commit crazy crimes. The second thing I wanted to talk about was entertainment. In the West, people are enslaved through entertainment. Look at, I grew up here. I know how it is. I grew up also as a non-Muslim. In the introduction you heard, I converted when I was 16. So before that, I was a regular American walking down the street. All that I cared about at that time was what movie was in the movie theater, what video game I could play when I go home, or what sports game is on, who's winning the World Series or the World Cup or whatever. That's all we care about. That's all only movies, TV, sports, video games, that's it. Nothing else. I don't care what's happening in the world politically. I would guarantee you that the large percentage of teenagers or even young adults don't even watch the news. The only time they even see the news is when they're flipping through the channels. That's it. No one cares about what's really happening in the world. They don't care about what's happening inside America, let alone what's happening outside of America. They don't care about what Israel is doing to Palestine. They don't care about what America is doing in Iraq and Afghanistan. They care about what movie they're going to see on Saturday night. They're being fooled by entertainment. The government is making them look this way while they're doing everything else that way. This is what's happening. The last one I wanted to mention is a little bit about marriage. And I want you to listen to this carefully, so send a loud salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
Now this is more cultural. This is not necessarily in regards to the West. It's in regards to ourselves as well. Now, many of the communities that I go to, I haven't been here too long. I haven't spoken to many people in detail about their lives. But wherever I go, in the UK, in Sweden, wherever I've gone, and I've been able to sit down with the community and talk to them about their problems, most of the time the women have serious problems with the way that they're treated in the household. And I can say in a lot of these places, the wives become slaves of their husbands. I want to explain what Islam says, what the duties of a wife are. Because once we realize what the duties of a wife are, we can see if a husband is stepping over the bounds or mistreating his wife. A wife has two duties. That's only two duties. One duty is, won't be mentioned today, because only to married couples I'll mention it. And the second duty is when they leave the house, they have to seek their husband's permission. Only these two duties, nothing else. That means cooking is not the wife's responsibility. Cleaning the house, vacuuming, cleaning the bathroom is not the wife's responsibility. Taking care of the kids, not the wife's responsibility. Even breastfeeding a baby, not the wife's responsibility. She has zero responsibility. The husband has 100% responsibility when it comes to that. I'm not telling the women don't do it. When the women do it, they get a lot of rewards. If a woman cooks for her husband, for Allah, she gets a lot of rewards. If she takes care of her children for Allah, she'll get all kinds of rewards. Everything that she does in the household is mustahab. She's getting rewards from the time she wakes up until the time she goes to sleep. Allah is praising her. I remember there is one person in Qom, one of the teachers of Akhlaq. And he came to one of my friend's houses and we were talking with him. They asked him, one of my friend's wife asked him, you know, what can we do as women? We have it so hard. How can we get closer to Allah? It's so difficult. And he looked at her and he said, women have it easy. Men have it difficult. Everything you do is mustahab. Every time you give your husband food, every time you clean your house, every time you take care of the children, every second that you're taking care of the children, if you do it for Allah, you're getting rewarded. Now in our culture, do we look at it like that? In Pakistani culture, Iranian culture, whatever culture, do we look at it that, oh, mashallah, my wife is so good. She does all of these things, and I appreciate her for everything she does. She doesn't have to, but I know she's doing it because she loves me. Are we thinking that, or do we think it's her duty? I know we think it's her duty. You think your wife has to make food for you. And only does she have to cook, she has to cook a salad, a number of different meals. It has to be ready the second I come home. When I come home, you have to greet me in some certain way. the house has to be spotless. The kids, you have to take the kids, you have to wash the clothes, you have to take the kids to school, you have to do the shopping, everything. This is wrong. This is wrong. And a woman has the right to say no, Islamically, but culturally she probably wouldn't be able to be. Now, the wives are enslaved by their husbands. That's why I said that, so it's a rough word. But if we are mistreating people, if our wives are oppressed, we really have to think about how we're living our lives. And I know it might be hard to hear, and it might not make any difference, but I feel it's my duty to say these things where I go, because unfortunately the women are, for the most part, put in very bad situations. Salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Back to the government. Now, I'm not saying that an Islamic government is perfect. In theory, it's perfect. In practice, it might not be perfect. Even the government of the Prophet, even the government of Imam Ali alayhi salam. They might not have been perfect societies. In the time of Imam Ali, there were wars against the government. People inside the country fought amongst the civil wars. When you're living in a country that's in a civil war, that's not a perfect society. There's problems there. But an Islamic government will be stronger, will benefit the society to the extent that the laws of Islam are followed. Now, in this case, I want to mention Iran as an example. I want to mention two different cases in Iran. Two cases that I've seen with my own eyes, or at least one of my teachers has seen. One of them is education, particularly women's education in Iran. Compare it before the Islamic Revolution to after the Islamic Revolution. My wife is Iranian. I married an Iranian when I was in Iran, and her whole family is there in Iran as well. Her mom is a very special person. And she's a very smart person, but she's uneducated. Before the Islamic Revolution, in a non-Islamic society, the conditions of schools were not conducive to women. They were not able to wear the hijab. They were mixed. It was not a proper place to send a religious family to send their child. So a large number of Iranian women who are of that age, of that generation, are uneducated because their family did not allow them to go to school. This is before the revolution. Now let's look at it today. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution and when Iran became an Islamic Republic, we see that today in the universities, there are more women studying in the university than men. Women are at a higher intellectual state than men in this society. We see a complete turnaround. Because in education, women have in this aspect in education, Iran has promoted Islamic values, and you see the effects. The second one that I want to mention is technology. I'll give you a story, and you can compare this to what Iran is now. Before the revolution, we know that Tehran was a modern city. America was there, other Western countries supported it. They lived pretty well. But the rest of Iran, was not the case. One of my teachers said after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, he went in his car, this is my teacher saying himself, he went in his car and he drove around to the villages in Iran to see the conditions of the people and to give them the good news. That's now we will be living in an Islamic government. And he said he reached one village that was way out there. That was very difficult to reach, it was very far. And many people didn't even know about this village. He said, when I got there, I was in my car and I drove there. When I stopped, the people came and they put hay, the thing that horses eat, they put hay in front of the car. This is in 1978. The people tried to feed the car hay. This is how people were in the villages in Iran. I myself visited some villages, and they're a lot better now than they were then. But they're still not where they should be. But 30 years ago, 32 years ago, these people was the first time that these people saw a car. That was amazing to me. Compared to today. Today in Iran, Iran is building nuclear energy. If America and other Western countries are furious about it. But Iran is able to produce nuclear energy. 32 years ago, they weren't able to make a refrigerator. 32 years later, they're making nuclear energy. It's an amazing progression. It's because they applied Islamic values to education, to technology, and you see the amazing advancements that they're making. Now, just because I got onto this topic for 1 second, I just want to make it clear to everybody. It's a peaceful nuclear program, not a military nuclear program. Sayyid Khamenei, the leader, the president, everybody is saying that it's haram to make nuclear weapons. So just so that's clear. Salawat ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
So therefore, what I'm saying, what I'm proposing is that politics and religion go hand in hand. They cannot be separated. The institution of secularism, or the ideology of secularism, is invalid. The separation of church and state, invalid. Islam believes that politics and religion are together. Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, he said, in one of his books that I was reading, he said that politics and religion cannot be separated from one another. They are one in the same thing. If a person does not agree with that, if one says that they should be separated, they do not understand politics, and they do not understand religion. This is Imam Khomeini. He's saying that politics without religion equals oppression. That if you have a political system that is not run by a religious institution, either by a person who is directly ordained by Allah, a prophet or an imam, or by someone that they themselves have ordained. If that's not the case, then it's oppression. So every single government in this world that does not follow that line, which is only one who does, are illegitimate and oppressive. The opposite, religion without politics. If you have religion without politics, it's fruitless. You won't get anywhere. All you'll be able to do is your individual acts of worship. You won't be able to improve the society. And as I mentioned before, I mentioned in a previous speech, Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi, who's one of the strongest scholars that we have in Islam, who's alive today, he was saying that the social responsibilities that we have are much greater and much more important than individual acts that we have. Even sometimes, hundreds of times more important. And he continues by saying that Salawat ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
So basically, politics and religion cannot be separated. We see when Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
We see when he entered Medina. Right? He was in Mecca. He was oppressed and he was persecuted. Islam was in danger and he was commanded by Allah to migrate. He migrated to Medina. What did he do? The first thing he did was establish an Islamic government. Once he was free of this persecution, once he was in a place where the people around him would not persecute him, would accept him, he established an Islamic government. We know that many of the laws of Islam, many of the ahkam that we hold so dear, were not established at that time. For instance, hijab. Hijab is the symbol of Islam. Wherever we are, men can blend into this society, but women wearing hijab are seen always. Wherever you go, you can always spot a Muslim woman who wears hijab. It's a symbol. It's important. When did it become wajib for women to wear hijab? From day one, when the Prophet was in Mecca, when the Prophet came to Medina, in the first year, second year, third year, fourth year, in the eighth year after the Prophet came to Medina, did the hijab become wajib. In about 20 years of the Prophet's mission, after 20 years, hijab became wajib. But the Islamic government was the first thing he did when he went to Medina. It was the most important thing that he did. Why? Why is it so important? What about an Islamic government is so important that was the first thing? There's a hadith by Imam Bakr alayhi salam.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
This hadith is a very important hadith. It explains a lot to us. And it's about wilayah. Now, government stems from wilayah, from guardianship. This hadith is about this. This hadith is saying wilayah is part of the pillars of Islam. He says, "Bunya al-Islam ala khamsati ashya." Islam is founded upon five things. Is based on five things. What are they? Al-salat wa zakat wa hajj wa sawm wa walaya. Upon prayer, zakat, charity, hajj, the pilgrimage, sawm, fasting, and walayat. The person who is narrating this hadith, the Imam is having a conversation with someone, his name is Zarara. Zarara was one of the strongest companions that we have. You'll see in many of our hadiths are narrated by him. He was always with the Imams, with Imam Bakr and Imam Saleh.
Now,
he asks Imam Bakr, he says, وَأَيُّ شَيْءٍ مِنْ ذَلَكَ أَفْضَلٌ. Which one of these is the best, is the most important? فَقَالَ, he responds, الْوَلَايَةُ هُوَ أَفْضَلٌ. Wilayat is the best, is the most important. Why? Ya Mawlana, Ya Imam, why is wilayat the most important? لَأَنَّهَا مِفَاتِحُهُنَّ. Because it is their key of them. It is their key. Now, first of all, when we look at the hadith, this hadith, we have to define what is wilaya. And then we'll figure out what it means that wilaya is the key. Now, people have mentioned this hadith numerous times. This is one of the most famous hadith that we have in the Shia world. I'm sure you've heard it before as well. The scholars say different things, give different interpretations of the word walaya. Some of them say walaya is love of the Ahlul Bayt. Some of them say walaya is tawassul, means tawassul. So what it's saying, the pillars of Islam are prayer and zakat and fasting and hajj and loving the Ahlul Bayt, or and tawassul, clinging to the Ahlul Bayt. But what I'm going to say is no, that's not the case. I'm not going to say it's not the case. I'm going to say it could be something else. It could be establishing a government as well. Walayat means government here, Islamic government. First, what I want to do, I want to mention one point regarding that so you don't think I'm sounding crazy or fanatic or anything like that. One of my teachers, Ayatollah Mukarram Shirazi, he states in his tafsir, he wrote a tafsir, it's called Tafsir Numunay in Farsi, it's 27 volumes. It's a very big tafsir. 4 of these volumes have been translated into English, inshallah they'll be published soon. Now, in this book, throughout the book, when he is describing different verses of the Quran, he has a certain system. First thing he does is he describes the circumstances of revelation, the Sha'n al-Nuzul. In these circumstances of revelation, a lot of times we have conflicting reports, or we have numerous reports. And what he says is that it's not that one of them is correct and the other one is incorrect. Both of them can be correct. The verse could have been revealed at both times. Why does one have to be correct and not the other? Why do we have to fight and see which one is right and which one is wrong? He says this. He has the same principle when he's trying to define a word, or he's trying to show what the instances of one of the words of the Quran is. For instance, let's look at the verse, وَاتَّسِمُوا بِحَبْلِ اللَّهِ جَمِيعًا وَلَا تَفَرَّقُوا, and hold fast to the divine cord and do not be divided. This divine cord, this Hablullah, there's traditions that explain it. This is a very important verse, brother. And there's traditions that explain this word. Some of them say the divine cord is the Quran. Some of them say the divine cord is Islam. Some of them say this divine cord is the Sharia. And some of them say this divine cord is the Ahlul Bayt. Now, a lot of times we Shias, because we love the Ahlul Bayt so much, we only see the Ahlul Bayt and disregard all of us. Ayatollah Mukarram Shirazi, when he explains this verse, he says all of them are correct. This divine cord is all of these things. Just saying that the divine cord is this instance and not that instance doesn't make sense. Why? Why do you have to do that? No, it could be all of them. In this tradition, the same thing. Walaya, I'm not saying that walaya doesn't mean love of the Ahlul Bayt. Of course, love of the Ahlul Bayt is a pillar of Islam. Of course it's important. But it doesn't mean that it's only love of the Ahlul Bayt. It can be establishing a government as well. And even when you think about it, stating that love of the Ahlul Bayt is the key to all of them, maybe a spiritual key. But establishing a government would be the physical key to those concepts. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
Therefore, what I'm saying is, this wilayat in this hadith, this wilayat that is the pillar of Islam, is not only loving the Ahlul Bayt. And loving the Ahlul Bayt in and of itself could only be part of the meaning. Because when we love the Ahlul Bayt, we have to listen to what they do. It's not just loving them to love them. Loving them means it changes our actions. If we really love somebody, sincerely, with our hearts, we would conform to what they want us to be. If the Ahlul Bayt has given us commands, we know that they're our imam, they're there. Our leaders, they're above us. And we say we love them. That means when they give us a command, we listen to it. We obey them. If that's not the case, we don't really love them. If you break the laws of Islam, if you disregard the commandments of the imams, you do not love them the way you should. You should please them by obeying them. You should please them by being subservient to them. If you're not, work on your hearts. Now I'm going to take a step back. And you might say that if establishing a government is so important, why didn't all the prophets establish governments? Why didn't all the imams try to establish governments? Why is it only a few? We know that there's only a handful of prophets that established governments. Hazrat Dawood, David, Hazrat Sulaiman, Solomon, Hazrat Musa, Moses, and our Prophet Hazrat Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. But what I'm going to propose to you is that if Abraham or Jesus have lived in circumstances where they could have, they definitely would have established a government. It's just that the conditions of the time that they lived in did not allow them to. Because there are certain conditions behind the formation of a religious government. There are certain necessities that have to take place, one of them being the people have to want it. If the people don't want it, you can't force it upon them. The people have to be willing to accept it. In the time of Prophet Jesus alayhi salam, the people were not willing. In the time of Prophet Abraham alayhi salam, the people were not ready. That's why they didn't establish it. But in the time of Prophet Musa alayhi salam, they were ready. And he did. In the time of our Prophet, they were ready and he established it. That's why some establish it, some don't. The imams, the same thing. Every single one of the imams wanted, desired, worked for the establishment of an Islamic government. It's just that the conditions did not allow it to happen. The people were not willing to take them as leaders. The government that was in charge were too physically powerful, and the imams did not have the ability in this world to do. That's why they didn't. Otherwise, if they could have, they would have. Now, don't take that as saying that the imams were unable to. Of course, we know that with du'as, and if they asked Allah, it would have happened. But they have to live their lives in accordance to the rules of the universe. That's why it didn't happen in their time. Now, I just wanted to mention that so no one thinks, you know, I'm trying to knock them or anything. Now, Imam Hussein alayhi salam knew that he was going to become a Shi'i. He knew before he left that he was going to be martyred. He had this knowledge. Therefore, because he had this knowledge, he had strong reasons to do it. He didn't just walk there to die just to die. He didn't do it without reason. There's a hadith of him explaining what his purpose is that I mentioned a few days ago. I didn't give you the whole hadith that day. I'm going to give you the continuation of it today. I'll read it to you in English and you'll see what Imam Hussein says about what I'm speaking about tonight. Imam Hussein alayhi salam says, Allah is speaking to Allah. You know that my revolution is not to rule over the people. I am the revolt, the revolution, the uprising, the movement, whatever you want to call it, is not to rule over the people. That sounds opposite to what I'm saying. So let's continue. Is not to obtain the glitter of the world. I'm not doing it to obtain riches, to become materially more well off. That's not the reason. So then what is the reason? Imam Hussein, why are you doing it? Rather, my intention is to establish a government. Establish a government. To teach the people about religion. So he's establishing the government, now he's answering why. What's the purpose of the government? Number one, to teach the people about religion. Number two, to reform the countries and cities. Reform. The first night we talked about reform. Number three, to establish peace. Establish peace. Why to establish peace? So that the servants can perform their obligations and recommendations. So that the servants could perform your laws. So three reasons for an Islamic government, Imam Hussein is saying. One is to teach people about religion. Two is to reform the societies, make them more spiritual, better them, improve them. Three is to create a peaceful atmosphere where people can serve their Lord in the way that He should be served. Salawat ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala
Muhammad. Now every night I mention that these speeches are meant to be practical and not theoretical. So far today it's been purely theoretical. How can we make this practical? How can we, by the fact that we know that one of the purposes of Imam Hussein's rising was to establish an Islamic government, how can we make that something practical in our own lives? Now, I'm not telling you to make America an Islamic government. Jumhuriya Islamiya America. I'm not saying that. Although that would improve the people's lifestyle here, that would improve the quality of life. Now this might be coming to mind, how is he saying that? Look at the countries that claim to be Islamic in the world today, and look at America. How could we improve the quality of life by having an Islamic government? Now, the reason that the countries that claim to be Islamic, some countries in the Middle East, the reason that they've fallen is because they haven't implemented the laws of Islam. Not because Islam is bad. Not because Islam is backwards, Auzubillah. They are falling because they're not listening to Islam. If they listened to Islam, they would rise, as I showed you in the comparisons with Iran. America, everything we look at, we have to acknowledge good things and bad things. There are plenty of bad things in America. So much so that I could come here and I could talk to you every day for a year easily about different, you know, problems in the American society. No problem, there's so many. But they're good things as well. We shouldn't close our eyes to the good things. There are parts of the American culture, there are parts of the American legal system which are in accordance to Islamic laws, which are in accordance to Islamic principles. That same person that I mentioned, Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi, that I mentioned earlier in the speech, he visited, I think, Canada. He visited a Western country. And when he came back to Iran, they asked him, "What did you see?" He said, "I saw Islam, but I didn't see Muslims." He said, "Of course, there are negative aspects." What he was doing was focusing on the positive. He was saying, there are certain aspects of Western life which are conducive to Islam. And it's because of those that they have been able to, you know, rise monetarily on a physical level. The more that a society, the more that a government, the more that a country obeys the laws of Islam, the better they will be. Islam provides this code of law, this Sharia, provided so people will have better lives in this world and the next. Now, as I said, America doesn't accept that. Even, I don't know if you guys read the news about this, but in Oklahoma, just a little while back, they passed a law saying that in the future, if someone wants to practice the Islamic law, the Sharia in Oklahoma, it's outlawed. They banned Islamic law in Sharia, which is just ridiculous. It doesn't make it. It's actually unconstitutional. And some Muslim lawyers came and overturned that. But they're scared of Islam. The American government, the American people, are scared of Islam because of how it's portrayed. So practically what I'm saying, what can we do? Practically, is education. Education. I'm not telling you to be politically active, at least on a federal level. I'm not telling you to do that. What I'm telling you to do is learn about the important issues of the day, learn the Islamic response to them, what Islam says about them, and then educate yourselves, your family, your community, and the people at large about them. For instance, healthcare. Healthcare is important. What does Islam say about healthcare? Does Islam agree with universal healthcare or not? Homosexual marriage. Does Islam agree with that or not? Proposition 19, the marijuana. Does Islam agree with that or not? What does Islam say about this? Can we educate people about the Islamic response to these issues? This is how we can implement this, through education. First, we become aware of the social issues of our community. Second, we learn the Islamic opinion about those issues. Third, we teach our communities the Islamic response to these important issues. 1, 2, 3, 3-step program. We can do it. That's how we can put it practically. That's how we can implement this in our lives. Salawat ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
Now inshallah, I want to move to the sands of Karbala and talk a little bit about what happened on that day. What sacrifices Imam Hussein alayhi salam made to try to do these things that we're talking about every night. To try to reform the society, to try to establish justice, to try to do all these things that I mentioned. What happened? What sacrifices did he have to make? I'm going to mention the last person to become shaheed before him tonight. And the last person that became shaheed before Imam Hussein alayhi salam was a small child, an infant, a little baby, someone who could not be more innocent, someone who did nothing to the people who killed him. Ali Asghar was a child, was an infant. He was only a few months old. He was still drinking milk from his mom. His mother was Rubab. Now, Rubab came from a family who were lovers of the Ahlulbayt. Her father had 3 children. Now, I don't think there's anyone else in history that did what he did. His father had 3 daughters. He married one of them to Imam Ali alayhi salam, one of them to Imam Hassan alayhi salam, and the third one, Rubab, to Imam Hussein. 3 of his son-in-laws were imams. It's a family who loved the Ahlul Bayt. So Ali Asghar was born from Imam Hussein and this woman. After everyone passed away, after all of the companions were slaughtered, after all of the family members were slaughtered, after Abbas was killed, no one remained. Imam Hussein alayhi salam knew that his time was running out. He knew he didn't have much time left. So one of the last things he did was he wanted to bid farewell to his son, his little baby. He called Zainab to go bring his son to him. Hazrat Zainab went to Rubab. Now it's not recorded what happened, what was said. But just imagine what Rubab was thinking. Rubab was experiencing a terrible day. All of Imam Hussein's friends were killed in front of her. Her family members, Imam Hussein's brother, her nephew, Imam Hussein's nephews, all of these people that she held so dear, that her family were such lovers of the Ahlul Bayt that they loved, were killed. Now Imam Hussein wants her infant child. What could be going through her mind? Zainab retrieved the baby, took it to Imam Hussein. Imam Hussein put the baby on his lap and started kissing it. It's been recorded in history that he was kissing this child. Imagine, you're saying goodbye to your little baby. Imagine that as a father, as a mother. Imagine, you know, this is the last time that I'm going to see this kid. This is the last time I'm seeing my son or daughter.